I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Doctor's Kitchen. Recipes, health, lifestyle.
As I went to leave the flat, I just went, this is an act of self-harm, take your shoes off. And I went and sat down with a cup of tea and just thought, right, this is how tenacious and nefarious this illness is. Because you have one sign of weakness and it's in.
Welcome to the Doctor's Kitchen podcast. The show about food, lifestyle, medicine, and how to improve your health today. I'm Dr. Rupi, your host. I'm a medical doctor, I study nutrition, and I'm a firm believer in the power of food and lifestyle as medicine. Join me and my expert guests where we discuss the multiple determinants of what allows you to lead your best life. Today, I have a very honest conversation about eating disorders, negativity bias, and the brain with Emma Guns and Katie Warriner. Katie is one of the UK's leading performance psychologists, working behind the scenes and on the big stage with some of the world's best athletes, leaders, and organizations. From the sports field to the boardroom, the helicopter pad to the operating theatre, Katie helps people train the mindset skills and practices essential to thriving under pressure. She's been embedded in Olympic sports for the last decade, supporting many of our most successful athletes at both the London 2012 and Rio 2016 Olympic Games. But she was also a professional athlete herself, who had to overcome the issues surrounding food being used solely as a tool for performance and how that was ingrained into her as an impressionable teenager chasing Olympic ambitions. Emma Gunavardhana is better known by her media name Emma Guns and is an award-winning journalist and podcaster who I describe as UK's answer to Joe Rogan. The Emma Guns Show covers topics including beauty, wellness, mental health, eating disorders, business, entrepreneurship, and finance. And she prides herself on covering a variety of topics in a way that will be relevant and meaningful to her global audience. And today, I wanted her to share her relationship with food and her personal experience of self-confidence and diet. Both of my guests are pragmatic thinkers as well as passionate advocates for supporting people to develop the mindset that they need to thrive. But I do want to exercise caution with today's show for anyone uncomfortable listening to stories around binge eating disorders, guilt, body dysmorphia, and depression. Today, you're going to hear about self-compassion and how our brains work, Katie's experience of negative self-image and body dysmorphia, how food can be naively perceived as a means to achieve something or equally to fill a void, connections as the antidote to shame, and why guilt is a natural and healthy emotion. Yes, you heard that correctly. Why guilt is something that we need to embrace in an appropriate way, and how we can use negativity as a foundation for change. In addition, Katie runs online courses for athletes who want to train their mental game, as well as for some who want to invest in their mental well-being. And listeners can get a discount to either of those courses by checking out the details at thedoctorskitchen.com. For now, enjoy the podcast. So thank you both so much for making the time this Friday morning to chat with me on the podcast. I love you both. Emma, you're a prolific podcaster. Like I described you as the female version of Joe Rogan in the UK, which I think is brilliant. And Katie, we were on a webinar a couple of months ago, all to do with mental health and specifically for healthcare practitioners. I'd love to start with your journey and your story, Katie, and what you do, and introduce you to the listeners.
Yeah, thank you, and thanks for having me. It's I'm really looking forward to the conversation and the lack of structure to see where we go. Good job. I sense all three of us like to go with the flow. So I mean, I guess the story kind of starts. So when I was younger, as an artistic gymnast, I was really, really passionate about the sport. There was nothing more I wanted to do with my life than do backflips and somersaults and train. And that sort of pursuit of perfection, you know, kind of a tumble well landed under pressure, it was, for one reason or another, was just absolutely what I was passionate about. However, I trained, like, by the age of about 12, I was training about 30 hours a week. I wasn't going to school. I was sort of exempted from school for various training sessions and so on. And over the years, my sort of love of the sport got sort of distorted because I had a really, really difficult relationship with a gymnastics coach that I worked with. I developed some really difficult sort of thoughts and feelings about myself, about my body image and all sorts of things. And ultimately, my love of the sport just sort of, it changed a lot. And I ended up at 15 or 16, I actually finished, having represented the country, travelled the world and had what in many ways was an amazing career, but not what I dreamt of. And I decided, I don't remember saying this, but my mum always tells me that at sort of 16, I turned around and said, I want to be there for others in the way that no one was for me. I want to help other athletes connect better with their coach, have a better chance of being understood and following their dreams. Back then, I guess I didn't really know that was a role, you know, sort of that brilliant naivety of when we're younger. So I went on to study psychology initially, I suppose, because I was interested in how much our brains can be developed, how much our ways of thinking and feeling about ourselves, you know, is that fixed? Am I just born tough, or can I work on my toughness? Can I work on my confidence? And the field of psychology is just, I'm so grateful for it because I've just absolutely loved learning about that. And now I'm sort of 15 years into a really, really fortunate career working primarily within Olympic sports, so within Team GB, and helping athletes and coaches to make the most of their sporting passions and talents. And I also work alongside a couple of really good colleagues in a few different sort of passion ventures in schools, so helping schools change the way they develop a self-esteem within young people and resilience. So really, really varied, but primarily anyone with a dream, I'm well up for helping.
That's amazing. There's so many elements of your story. I really want to unpick that. I don't know where to start. I mean, I guess it never fails to amaze me how many times I have someone on the podcast who is doing some incredible feat, whether it be in something clinical, whether it be something outside, who's had a powerful personal story that has fueled their desire and fueled their passion. And I wonder, you know, when you were 16, you felt unsupported. What things are you doing now? How has your personal experience helped you create a structure or a framework or a cushion for people who are in the same sort of high performance pursuit as you were?
Good question. And I'm still on a journey with it myself. So if you were to interview some of the athletes I've worked with over the years, a lot of them wouldn't actually know anything about my story, or wouldn't even know that I used to be an artistic gymnast myself. Over the last few years, I think as you get more and more comfortable in your skin, I've noticed that I'm more comfortable talking about it. And even like talking with you guys today, it's quite a privilege actually. I used to think that, I really wanted to go to the Olympic Games, win an Olympic gold medal, and then use the story and use what I'd learned to help other people achieve their dreams. I used to think that was the way to do it. Over the course of my career and with some, you know, fantastic mentors, Pippa Grange, Steve Peters, various people that have supported me, I've come to actually learn that the suffering I had is probably at the heart of why I'm able to hopefully make a difference to athletes, coaches, and you know, leaders, teachers today, because I understand what it's like to lose a dream. I understand what it's like to feel that kind of pain and that sort of sense of loss and that sort of misunderstanding. And I am so, so motivated now to help other people not have that, but to grow through their experiences, to, you know, to feel supported. So I think initially, just intuitively, because I'm genuinely, you know, like we all are, we're following our passions and being true to ourselves and sort of trying to not build a life based on a CV, but based on, you know, the eulogy metaphor of who do you really want to be and what do you want to do with this one precious life. And so I think that just organically, I hope, comes through, and I'm kind of, I guess I'm in it for the right reasons for me personally. But I have over the last few years been able to share a little bit more, and I think that just adds authenticity to it. But I'm still figuring Absolutely. It out. It's a good question. I'm still figuring it out.
Yeah. I mean, it's a privilege for you to even want to share your story. I think on a podcast, it demonstrates that, you know, that maybe not the comfortability of being vulnerable, but certainly your authentic self. And I know this is probably really hard for Emma to not jump in with questions there, because you are a podcaster, and I'm sure you're thinking of like, oh, I'd love to ask about this. So I'm going to ask you to talk about you for once, actually, because I know after listening to so many of your pods, you're an amazing hostess. You're an amazing person who has, you know, some really poignant questions. But I want to turn the lens on you and allow you to tell your story.
Thank you. It's so interesting listening to Katie's story, actually, because I've made notes instead of butting in. So things that you mentioned: mentors, failure, confidence, self-esteem, suffering. And I wrote those down because they are things that I think I can relate to, and I think a lot of people can probably relate to. And I think I started out as a journalist in beauty, or writer in beauty, and wanted to work on magazines because I thought it was incredibly glamorous. And so that was my dream, in the way that I guess going to the Olympics was your dream. And I somehow managed to get there. I mean, there was a lot of luck involved, but there was also an awful lot of graft. But it wasn't necessarily the dream that I thought it was going to be. And I really struggled with that. I really struggled with the fact that I thought that this was going to be this glamorous life. But in addition, I think I realized that I didn't have any self-esteem. I didn't have any self-confidence. So I wanted to become the beauty editor of a magazine because I thought, well, if that's my identity, then people will like me. I will be valid. That will give me the thing that will mean that I will be able to walk into a room and not feel anxious and not feel that I'm the worst person in the room. And so I aspired and tried really, really hard just to get that label, just to have that identity. And then when I got there, it was like, and now what? It was so that was really a bit of a struggle. And that's, I guess, the thing that has really informed the podcast, insofar as I can't be alone in having all these self-destructive, self-sabotaging thoughts and feelings. And it's so easy to project onto other people around you that they're absolutely winning at life and they've got everything sorted and they know how everything runs, and they walk into a room and they feel great. Everybody has gone through something. Everybody has had their failure. Everybody has had their issues with self-esteem. And I think it's really helpful to share those stories. And so that, I guess, is the basis of why the podcast was born, because the really good stuff, the really good stories, and the real growth comes from your own failure, but also understanding other people's. And there's a great RuPaul quote, which is, the part of the place on the bone that was broken becomes the strongest part in the bone. And I love that, because I like the idea of thinking that actually your failures do make you stronger, and I do believe that they do.
I need to write that absolutely. Down as well.
I know, I'm literally writing that down.
I'll send you a meme.
RuPaul quote. Yeah, of course. And, you know, obviously the Doctor's Kitchen podcast focuses on nutrition and diet, as well as all the other aspects of lifestyle medicine. And obviously we want to go into the other wider determinants of what makes people ultimately happy, as well as successful, whatever their definition of success is. And for you, Katie, you know, one of the things in terms of how you described it as the pursuit of perfection would have been diet and the restriction that is almost necessary when it comes to pushing out performance as an athlete. How was that for you? If we could just zoom in on that perspective.
Tough. Yeah. And I've got a little baby girl now, Isla, who's coming up to two, and I often look at her, she's jumping everywhere, she wants to climb on everything, and I'm thinking, gosh, I really want to take her to like a little baby gym. And then I have this other voice that comes and saying, no, I do not want that for her. But I mean, gymnastics is working hard to change. But when I was training, I mean, from the age of 10 onwards, I was weighed constantly at training, a couple of times in a training session even, which just scientifically now, and there's no merit to that kind of behaviour. My coach spoke to my parents about my diet and, you know, how rice cakes would be a good idea for dinner because it's very low calories. And food became just purely about how to be as lean as possible, because gymnastics has the two benefits. There's obviously the aesthetic, for some reason, you know, slimmer is what was considered better. And also then you can somersault more, it's easier to rotate in the air and all the rest of it. So if food became very difficult and with that, then it just became a source of control of like, I can't guarantee if I'm going to win a medal, but I can guarantee how many calories. I had, you know, had one of those little books, at the age of 12, like counting calories, and you can't unlearn that. You can't unlearn how many calories are in a piece of bread and so on. And so learning how to work with that. And there was a really, really transformational moment for me when I was sort of in my later teens, around about 18, where I realized that I was constantly avoiding going out for dinner with friends, with school friends and then university friends, because I wasn't able to then know what would be on the menu and how to control that side of things. And there was just this moment where I thought, gosh, you know, I would swear, but I'd try not to. Like, this is not okay. I want to live my life more fully. I mean, food is such a beautiful part of connecting with people and sharing moments. And food is like so full of pleasure. It's not just something to be controlled and counted. And so it's been a real journey. And I mean, not every gymnast walks out with an eating disorder, but I think on the disordered spectrum, I know more that do than don't. And I think it's so difficult for it not to become so connected in with your self-esteem and how you're valued and whether or not you're going to get selected.
Yeah, I know this is a very sensitive topic, so I want to tread carefully with all the different questions that I ask. But Emma, you have your own sort of story and your own journey with regard to an obsession or a disordered relationship with eating.
Yeah, 100%. So the bit of the puzzle that I missed out about the girl who got the job as a beauty editor on a magazine, the thing that I stopped myself from saying was I didn't want to be the fattest beauty editor in the room. And I was. and from a very young age, I was very doll-like. And I was talking to someone recently and I said it was almost as if I could divide my childhood into before and after fat. So I was quite doll-like until about the age of 8, and then suddenly I changed. And it was a very stark lesson from the age of 8 that you can't really compute at the time. But you understand that the world treats you very differently based on how you look. When you're a cute little kid, the world's your oyster. When you're not a cute little kid, the world is not. And obviously I'm sort of simplifying it for whatever reason. But I had a very early onset PCOS, so that's polycystic ovarian syndrome. And my symptoms were quite severe and they went undiagnosed until I was 17. So in the interim, around 8-9 years old, my mother took me to the doctor. Emma's putting on a lot of weight. And I was told I was obviously eating too much. And here's a list of diet foods, and a little bit like you, Katie, just very different settings. Just Emma probably shouldn't eat chocolate. Emma needs to move more. And I really understood the focus of food's now a bad thing, food's wrong. And that really, I guess, started the first knot into what became a huge, huge tangle in terms of body image. And it was only 2 years ago, so in 2019, I actually had a breast reduction. And it was perfectly, I was a very good candidate for a breast reduction anyway. And I didn't understand this at the time. It wasn't until afterwards I realized that a lot of the reason why I'd undergone surgery, you know, general anesthetic invasive surgery, was because I thought that if I didn't have big boobs that I would look slimmer. So you can imagine the shock when I didn't have the result that I was expecting. And actually, but it was a very useful thing, because I did that thing where I looked in the mirror and just thought, you can't do this, you can't keep doing this, you're 41, are you really going to be, is this going to be the one thing in your life you can't get a handle on? Is this going to be your legacy? Emma spent her whole life being unhappy with her weight and never got on top of it. So I just had to give myself an extremely tough pep talk. And also look at it from a completely different perspective. I had over the years been extremely good at dieting, and I had been over the years extremely good at working out with discipline and with consistency. And at 6 o'clock in the morning, I would be in the gym and I would be doing my workouts. And even the trainers would come over and be like, God, look at what you've done. This is amazing. But I could not sustain it. And so the thing that I really understood, and which is its own journey in itself, is it's not actually about the food. It's not about the exercise. It's about what's going on in here. And I had to interrogate that. And that was the hardest piece of the puzzle, but the best work that I've been able to do in terms of just feeling connected to my body and feeling as though I have some sense of confidence and self-esteem that I realise I never had before.
For me, like, not to kind of put you on the spot too much, but that's why what you do is so beautiful, that you might not realise it, but what you do for me is you encourage me to be passionate about food, to learn about what's possible and the creativity and how to kind of like nutrify your body with it. And like there's so much connectedness between what we're all doing without it being sort of on the surface necessarily obvious. Sorry, I interrupted your flow.
Oh, no, thank you. No, that's very sweet of you. I was literally just going to bring you in and just say, Katie, this is not only from, you know, your personal experience, but this is sort of your bread and butter, I imagine, because you're exposed to a lot of people who are having these sorts of thoughts and these sorts of feelings around food, albeit in a different sort of industry in terms of athletes.
Yeah, I mean, I think you touched on it at the end there, Emma. You're spot on that it's never really about the food. It's what the food represents for someone, whether it represents a way to feel a little bit more in control of a world that we're not in control of, or whether it represents a way to feel a sense of achievement because this is something that I can do and I can see a result from it. Often, I've met a number of athletes that are eating to fill a void because essentially they're very much trying to achieve something in sport in order to feel good enough. The amount of Olympic champions, premiership footballers, CEOs that I've worked with over the years that on paper seem like they've got it all, like, you know, really, really impressive. They're achieving dreams, they're standing on podiums, they've got shiny things around their neck, and they feel empty from it. And they feel like they kind of almost like, what was the cost of this journey? Was it worth that price? And actually, I thought when I stood here on top of this podium that I would feel so full of joy, but actually I don't. And there's a really, not a very scientific source, but one of my favourite sources of sports psychology is, you know, the Cool Runnings film. And there's a quote in that, which is, if you're not enough without a medal, you'll never be enough with a medal. And that's sort of like, when I heard that, I was like, I could never express that as well. That's at the heart of my work. Actually, I don't do an awful lot about sport specific psychology. I do a little bit around, you know, penalty shootouts or decision making or managing nerves, that kind of stuff. But really, the most powerful work I've come to have the privilege of being involved in is helping athletes and coaches realize that they are enough as they are. You are a human being, not a human doing. Who do you want to be in the world? Now let's go and pursue something that you want to do for fun, not for fear. Not for fear that you're not good enough, that you need to get this medal in order to be good enough, to be loved or valued. And just that kind of like stripping it back to what it is to be a human being has been completely transformational, actually, for me, for those I've worked with. And that's not what you get taught at psychology school. Kind of, you know, it's not in the curriculum. It really, really should be. And I want to be a part of changing that in schools. But yeah, it's just that sort of recognising why you're doing what you're doing and having that be healthy through a sort of root of love.
It's absolutely that. And I think someone might listen to me talk and say, well, what did you do? Did you just go on a diet? But it was about that different approach. So previously, the way that I ate, it was self-sabotaging, and there was no connection between what I'm eating and nurturing or looking after myself. And the same with exercise. It was almost a punishment. I mean, I enjoyed it, but my motive for doing it was almost like, I'm going to punish you until you lose weight. And it was changing the mindset to, I'm going to feed myself in a way that somebody who really loved me would feed me. And I'm going to exercise in a way that somebody who really wanted me to remain fit and strong and healthy would want to, because there's that great James Altucher quote, nobody wakes up in the morning and wants your success more than you do. Like, it has to be you that wants it. So I listen to all these inspirational podcasts and I tap into all this inspirational stuff from James Altucher and RuPaul. But just when it came to how I viewed my body and whether that's because I succumbed to diet culture or not, I wasn't actually at any point, nothing I was doing was about an act of self-care or self-love or liking myself. It was all about you've got to change. If you and flipping that vocabulary and sort of, you know, doing a chart on a piece of paper and going, this is what I'm currently saying. What would be the positive opposite? It was just flipping into that headspace, which obviously doesn't just happen overnight, but that would be my thing. It is switching the gears.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, considering the environment that you were working in for a large part of your career in the beauty industry, it just reminds me, I feel like this podcast is turning into Quote Central here, but you know the Baz Luhrmann song, don't read beauty magazines, they only make you feel ugly. That was your constant environment. And probably across your desk, you were seeing the latest diets, latest fads, the look that everyone should be trying to achieve. And to pull on Katie's point, you really have to try and establish the why of everything that we do. Why are we trying to look a certain way? What is meaning to us? What is success for us? And bringing that out. I mean, what was that process like for you, Emma, in terms of really changing that mindset? Because I imagine, particularly as you're working in the industry at such a young and impressionable age, it would have become part of your personality, part of your fabric.
Oh, absolutely. And I was already very much, I already knew that the images of women that I was seeing on television, they were things that I aspired to, but I knew I didn't look like that. So I was already punishing myself for that, even if I necessarily knew. But yes, I remember a few years ago going around to a friend's house and she said, oh, I'm going to, I don't know, well, should we get a takeaway tonight? And I said, oh, I'm doing this thing. And she just put her head in her hands and she said, every time you visit, you're doing a new thing and based on something that you're trying for the magazine or that you've heard about or that one of your beauty editor friends, she's like, can we just have a takeaway? And can you just eat it? And can we not take out a food group? And I hadn't really realized until then how indoctrinated I was into all of these things. Like one minute you're cutting out carbs, one minute you're trying something else. I mean, I can't even list off the amount of things I've tried. So I was very susceptible to it and I did completely fall for it. But I think the difference in, I read a book called Brain Over Binge and it's by an author, Catherine Hanson. And that really, I read it at a point the day after I'd looked in the mirror and I had said, we're not doing this at 50, Emma. And this is the same woman who had looked in the mirror at 16 in the summer holidays between the fifth form and the sixth form being uniform, sixth form being own clothes, and had said, you're not going to be a fat sixth former, and was. And so I just didn't want to keep having that conversation with myself. Like, really, I didn't. So I read the book Brain Over Binge. A friend had recommended it to me, someone, a really good friend who's recovered from anorexia. And she said, I know that you don't have my issues, but I think this might help. And I was quite cross at the idea that I might have binge eating, because even the idea of binging or admitting to a binge was just so shameful. I was just, how could you possibly say that I would do that? And I read it in one sitting. So technically I binged it and I did speak to the psychotherapist, Mandy Saligari, about that. And she went, let me get this straight. You binge read a book about binge eating. And we had a laugh, but it's not like it's particularly scientific. It's not even particularly well structured or well written, but it's incredibly repetitive. And about two chapters in, I thought, this is almost like hypnosis. And it definitely, and I thought, I'm going to go with this. And it was, I genuinely mean this. I read it in what, 5-6 hours with, and I highlighted sections and I went to bed and it was as if overnight I had had a software update. And when I woke up the next morning, the way that my behavior around food was changed forever, not permanently, because we can talk about relapses and setbacks, but it just fundamentally helped me understand that what I was doing was self-sabotaging. And there was this constant conflict where I spent my life talking to my friends saying, does my bum look big? Do I look big in that? Do you think I'm fat? All of these things. So I was a real Debbie Downer to be around. And I was constantly looking for reassurance from other people. And that made me realize that this is just something that I had to completely break. That way I was thinking was something that had to be broken because it's unbelievably, unhelpful.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Katie, I mean, I want to bring you in here because that mindset shift, I'm assuming it won't happen for a lot of people after reading one book or having some content, no matter how vested you are in that interest. And this is something that you do a lot of in various guises. How do you try, is there a tried and tested process for developing a different mindset? Or is it really, really unique to the individual and where they're coming from?
It's one of the most brilliant things and most annoying things about human beings is how individual we all are and how I so wish there was a magic wand. But I mean, it's so amazing to hear that story, Emma, because I imagine there were lots and lots of nudge points that led up to that moment and then the book helped tip it over. There's so much there that you're touching on about, you know, really understanding why, what is sitting behind, what is the, because every behavior makes sense in context. Like every behavior is kind of almost, if you think of it like armor, perhaps, like there would have been some difficulties or challenges in someone's upbringing in their early years, whereby they felt overwhelmed by something or they felt they weren't good enough. And so then with not just a kind of, it's not a young adult brain we have at the age of 10 or 12, it's an incomplete brain. It's like a car that's got, you know, eventually it's going to have six gears, but right now it's only got three. So you can't expect, you know, a younger person to really think clearly about the world or themselves or other people. And yet by the age of about 8 or so, we have actually formed a bit of a map of ourselves, other people, the world. Are we lovable? Are we good? Are we full of potential or not? Can other people be trusted or not? Are they consistent or not, depending on what we've experienced from parents and those close to us, early caregivers? And is the world a safe place or not? So we're forming these conclusions that then form a map of the world for us and how we interact with it. But we're doing it with an incomplete brain. We're doing it with a really emotionally driven brain that is quite egocentric. So it takes everything very personally. So simple things like dad is away working a lot, for example, the young incomplete brain may conclude from that I'm not that special because dad's away a lot, so therefore I'm not really that special. And then they'll develop sort of like these kind of subconscious rules for living about, right, well therefore I need to go out and achieve lots and lots of things in order to be really special. So now you've got the emergence of a drive, but it's being driven by dysfunction. It's being driven by a feeling of not being good enough. And then that drive can then go on to, you know, you can achieve great things with that, but like we've touched on, at a great cost as well. So when people are able to unpick, what is it that happened in, you know, I'm really, although I'm not a clinically trained psychologist, I've been mentored and supervised, you know, for over a decade now. So I very much think in that way. I do think that those early life experiences are completely profound for how we then interact with the world. So when you're able to take someone back to that and see life through the age of Emma as an 8-year-old or, you know, whatever was relevant at that time, you can then go about some very powerful healing of thinking, actually, what was the truth of that? What was the reality of that situation? You change that bottom line about yourself. So if you literally can switch it from I'm not good enough to that's not even a question. Like, where is the bar? Like, what is the level of being good enough? Just you are a human being, and that's beautiful. And we don't really know what we're doing on this planet, but what do you want to do with your life? Who do you want to be? And so when you switch that, all of those old rules, I need to be excellent, I need to be really liked, I need to be the thinnest person in the room, whatever it might be, all of those can drop away in an instant. So that kind of approach can create massive change in a short space of time. I'm not really sure I've answered the question. I kind of went...
No. I was just going to bring Emma back there and just ask if that's brought... if that's brought anything up for you.
Obviously. I'm curious because I think the thing with my own particular journey, my own colour and shape of what I have experienced, is that for a long time I was in a place of denial. And I wonder if I'd read that book 10 years earlier, whether it would have resonated, whether it was I was in the right emotional and mental headspace. I just dropped a lot of money on some cosmetic surgery, didn't get the result I wanted. So I was like, right, I'm going to sort this out. So there were lots of factors at play, like you said, lots of nudge points. But I think for a long time, I used my PCOS as a reason why I was overweight. And I would present that to people very early on in my interactions with them. So that, because I went through a big period, I don't know if you went through this too, Katie, of I actually didn't want people to see me. and I didn't want them to see what I was physically presenting. So I would try and rush to tell them things about me so that they would cut me some slack and maybe see a version of me that I would feel happier for them to see. So there was a lot of presenting and posturing, but definitely denial. And I think I have had this conversation a couple of times with friends who, again, everyone's journey is unique and it has its own colour and its own shape, but friends who have gone down the body acceptance route. And I stumble with that because I feel strongly that had I done that 2 years ago, instead of reading that book, that would have been validating a mental illness rather than, and I feel very happy about the journey that I've gone on. And I worry about, well, what if I had embraced all of the tenets of body acceptance? Would that have meant that my health was at risk in the long term? There are questions I have, and I know that that will be quite upsetting for some people to hear, and I don't mean to trigger anybody. These are just the thoughts that I have given my own personal journey. And I guess what I'm coming back to is this, the idea of denial, actually, about knowing that maybe you have an issue, never actually getting on top of it, and so finding comfort in denial.
And I think that's right. And then just trying to, from that denial, trying to find some compassion in looking at what is this behaviour doing for me? Because I was working with a gentleman a couple of years back, and he very much had a belief that he was not lovable, and as not consciously, but he was unhealthy. Like, he was not eating any of the kind of nutritious things that Rupi would have us cooking up, you know. And so that behavior, basically, if you don't feel that you're lovable, then the pain of rejection is really cuts deep. So then one way to sort of protect yourself, in quote marks, is to eat an awful lot, make yourself considered as by society unattractive, and then you can't be rejected because they're not rejecting you for who you are, just because of the size you are. So that behavior was serving a purpose for him. It made sense in the context of his life. And once he was able to see the reason why I'm eating so much is to actually make myself, you know, kind of to confirm the belief I already have, our brains like consistency, to try and confirm that belief, then actually he was able to step back from that behavior and do something very, very different and think, do you know what, actually the original belief was faulty, and that can change in an instant. But I guess sort of slightly contradicting myself, that instant, as you said, Emma, has a number of points that lead up to it. And suffering, you know, the dropping a load of cash on suffering can drive that change. So find the silver lining.
Absolutely. There's a few themes that I think are emerging from this conversation. Root cause, I think, which is highly individualized, whether it's something from your immediate environment or childhood environment or cultural history as well. I think that has a huge interplay. And there was one element that you mentioned, Emma, that I want to pick up on, which is the elephant in the room being, you know, what is the appropriate thing to advise people of in consideration of the psychological impact, but also we have to consider the immediate issue of, if you are overweight, and yes, we are moving away from BMI, but if you are of an unhealthy lifestyle, we do need to make steps toward improving that for your benefit, not for society, but for the individual's benefit. So there is a tricky balance to do that. And I think no more treacherous is it to do that on social media, as I'm finding, as I've found over the last couple of years. I mean, how do you feel we can approach those really important conversations in consideration of how sensitive a topic it is?
It is a very sensitive and tricky subject, and it's hugely nuanced. And I don't know as if there's a right or wrong answer right now, but in terms of being somebody who has gone to the GP previously and said, I'm gaining a lot of weight and I'm really unhappy about it, and being told to move more and eat less, essentially, which is sound scientific advice, by the way, but it was a blunt instrument in that case. And I think I really look forward to a time when somebody sits in a GP's office, and I totally understand the stresses and the lack of resources. So I totally understand that you can't have a perfect session and you can't examine all of this in one sitting. But I do think that just speaking to the person and just understanding their relationship with food, Like if you are gaining weight and you don't want to, or you're at a weight that you're not at and you don't want to be at that weight, which was my issue for a very long time. I was very unhappy with it. So you just telling me to eat a bit less and go on a diet, all things I've done and succeeded at, but they weren't the answer. So clearly the answer was something else. And so I just hope we get to a point where it's okay to ask people, what's your relationship like with food? How do you interact with food? There are certain behaviours. I'm sure there's a checklist. Like, for example, have you ever thrown food in the bin and then thought, it's only on the top, it's okay if I go back and nibble the stuff that's not dirty? There's a lot of behaviours, and I know a lot of people have done that. And there's also the restriction. I don't want to go down the list of listing them, actually, because I think I'm giving too much away. But I just think that there are really toxic behaviours around food that actually evidence the fact that it isn't about dieting and exercise. It's about, what are you using food for? I was scared of food. I relapsed a little bit at the weekend, insofar as I spent the whole morning, 6 hours, just thinking about what I could eat, and don't exercise because you're clearly tired, because I'd worked out all week and my muscles really hurt. So I thought, I need a rest. Oh, maybe I need to eat something. I really fancy a pizza. And I just had this 6 hours of just, can I have pizza? Can I do this? Should I get a cider? What if I have crisps? Oh, I really fancy nachos. And that was all that was going on in my head. And I got ready to go out to the supermarket. And thank goodness this happened because of the work that I've done. But as I went to leave the flat, I just went, this is an act of self-harm. Take your shoes off. And I went and sat down with a cup of tea and just thought, right, this is how tenacious and nefarious this illness is, because you have one sign of weakness and it's in. So
great words, by the way. Tenacious and nefarious. I'm loving that. But I think it, just building on what you said there, Emma, and it's back to Rupi, the point you're making about root cause, that actually, like, let's talk about this because we want to live life fully. We're not talking about this because you need to lose weight to be acceptable. We're talking about this because we have, as far as we know, we have this one shot at life, and you want to be able to, like, your body is a beautiful vehicle to express yourself, to connect with others, to adventure, to, you know, not everyone needs to climb a mountain, but, like, you know, maybe you want to play football with your kids, and, like, what is it you want to be able to express in life, and how do you want to use these moments, and you want to sit and feel well within yourself. So it's the reason why we're talking about this is one of, like you're saying, is one of love, of self, love of life, love of possibility, love of self. And so as opposed to the sort of previous narrative of it's what's acceptable, it's what you need to do in order to be liked, or in order to be considered, you know, in control of your life. Like, none of us are in control. Like, so I think that for me is sort of at the heart of how we change it. And then also, I mean, I'm really geeky about this. I just really wish, and really what I want to be a part of, is at schools that we teach kids how their brain work, because you have this unbelievable machine between your ears, and most of it has the power to make your life an absolute misery or a complete joy, bearing in mind whatever circumstances you're in. And yet there are no, like, rules. There's no manual. Like, even when I get a new phone, I don't really read the guidelines anyway. No one reads that. I mean, do they? I'd love to know if they do, because I don't. I hear my dad's voice in my inner saying, have you read the instructions? I'm like, no, I'm just trying to, you know. And that's what we do with life. We just sort of try and figure it out as we go. And actually, once we come to understand how our brains evolved and why they are here and how they're wired and why we have those awkward thoughts or doubting thoughts, or that's a game changer. Like, that's, I mean, I, you know, Pythagoras's theorem, I might be useful, but let's talk about our brains more.
I think we spend a lot of time teaching kids theory when actually we need to be teaching them a mixture of, yeah, how our brains work, logic, finances, life skills like food and cooking, and how to navigate marketing messages as well. That there's a whole host of things that I wish were added to the curriculum, and I definitely welcome some of the topics that you want to talk about to children. And on the point about, you know, with my GP hat on and the knowledge of how limited we have, how limited our time is we have with patients, there has to be a balance with education and compassion. And so this compassionate information giving is something that's very hard to work into the confines of a normal GP appointment, but it's definitely something that we need to work toward. And one thing I want to ask about is the other side, which is perhaps ignoring the bigger issues in basically sacrificing what could be useful for the individual in terms of, yes, things about moving more and lifestyle and food and how to include more vegetables and all those different things in the sort of fear of triggering a psychological problem. And therefore we create another set of rules where we can't talk about how you need to perhaps eat less or smaller portions or change your diet up. Because we're moving too far the other way. Am I making sense? I'm certainly noticing this trend on social media where it's unfashionable to be having a conversation about food.
I mean, Emma, it's probably a little bit more in sort of your world than mine, but I just think that the ability to try and... you lose so much context over social media, don't you? Like, there's a psychologist called Albert Mehrabian who did some studies around how do we interpret the meaning of what someone says to us? And most of us think like it's all about what you say, the words you use. In his research, he found that, I think, I'm going to get the stats right, but it was something like only 7% of the meaning of a communication is actually taken through your words. And the rest, 38%, I think, if I can't remember right, came from your tone of voice, and 55 from your body language. And yet when you put a comment on an Instagram or you put a post out, I mean, maybe you've got a video so you can capture some body language and tone. But the point I just feel about this is it's so difficult to connect genuinely over social media, even when we're being as brave as we are today of just being really real with each other and the moment. So we're trying to create those moments. And how you do that as a doctor, Rupi, I mean, my sessions are typically like 90 minutes. Like, you probably have like 7 minutes, don't you? I mean, it is really, really difficult. How do we have the genuine conversation so that if I'm going to give you a difficult message about portion size or whatever it is, I mean, you probably do need to talk to me about that, that I can trust that you're doing it for the right reasons, that you're doing it because you care about me. And that's really hard to achieve, whether it's in a doctor's surgery or over social media. But if we can talk about the fact that that's hard to achieve, then perhaps we can move towards it. Not sure if that made any sense, but...
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. Emma, do you have thoughts on that?
Well, I think I've noticed what you've noticed as well, which is this thing of we can't talk about food flat out because that could trigger anybody. Even talking about healthy food like your bang bang cauliflower, you know I'm a fan. Like, you can't necessarily talk about what you do because someone might interpret a message of, but you're shaming people who don't want to eat plant-based or who don't want to eat for their health. You're shaming somebody who would really like to just eat because they like the taste of that thing. And there's this really... Yes, there is an intolerance now towards talking about food generally, even if you're trying to put out good, healthy information. And for crying out loud, you're a doctor, so that's exactly what you're doing. But there does seem to be an intolerance towards any of it because of who it might upset. But I do think that is a social media thing.
Yeah. No, I agree. And I think it's definitely something that warrants attention, because I think traditionally we've thought too much with the authoritarian vibe on, like, you need to do exactly what I say, you need to lose weight, this is what you do, go and do it, you're clearly not taking my advice, hence why you're still overweight or you still got these issues with your bloods, etc., etc. And we certainly are hopefully moving away from that, but I fear, you know, in some cases we need to have a conversation around restriction, for want of a better word. But Katie, there was something that you mentioned on the webinar that we did about where restriction or guilt and how that spirals into shame and negative self-thought and ruminations. That's the issue right there. To, you know, we need some of over here, some restriction, some guilt, but it's, we need to be careful about the spiraling. And that's quite difficult to communicate in social media and a time limited appointment.
And it's linked to how we relate to our emotions and how we... I absolutely love Liz and Molly. I don't know if anyone's seen that on... Oh, they're amazing. They've got a book called No Hard Feelings. Oh, like they put out these really great sketches of our emotions at work and how actually we need to really embrace our emotions more and be able to talk about it and move on from the narrative that it's weak to talk about your emotions. You know, I've worked in men's team sports for over a decade now and big, massive, burly rugby players. Players, like, I might ask them, like, how are you feeling? And they'll say, I'm thinking about what I'm going to do in training. I'm like, that's nice. That's a thought. How are you feeling? I'm feeling ready to go. That's trying to get to feelings is so critical. And then talking about feelings, like, let's take guilt, for example. Yeah, what we talked about before, Rupi, was guilt can be and should be viewed as a really healthy emotion. It's a really healthy emotion that sends off a bit of an alarm to say, do you know what? I've done something wrong. I've done something against my values. Maybe I want to be healthy and I want to love and nurture myself. And I've just gone and eaten a ton of chocolate without any mindfulness. I didn't even enjoy it. I got to another packet and I thought I had another bit left, but I didn't because I wasn't even paying attention in the first place. So actually, I feel a bit guilty about that. And now we've got the risk of like, oh, it's eating disordered, but it's not. Guilt is a healthy emotion that says I did something against my values, and that guilt motivates us to do something about it. I'm going to treat myself a bit better. I'm going to call that friend that I forgot whose birthday it is, whatever it might be. I'm going to pick up the phone to my mum because I've not spoken to her in a while. So guilt can drive us to back to our values, can drive us to do healthy, positive things. And it's an emotion to be listened to and respected. But what happens more often is that guilt, as you said, spirals into shame. The difference is guilt is I did something wrong. Shame is I am wrong. There is something wrong with me. And from there, it's like, where do we go? Where do you go from there now? Like you then now spiral down. Whereas guilt can project us forward towards positive action. Shame keeps us trapped within ourselves. Now, if there's something wrong with me, I now need to retreat. I don't want to be seen. And then actually I'm going to do more of that kind of behavior. So then when, whether it's food, exercise, whatever it is, whenever it becomes linked to shame, then it's so difficult to talk about and work with because it feels so deeply personal when the reality is it's often helpful not to see it like that. And that links back to...
Exactly, yeah. This really links back to how you want people to understand how our brains work in terms of the neurochemical changes that occur when we perform actions and how we respond to those. And one of the things, and obviously this isn't going to happen overnight for people, you know, suddenly guilt is a healthy emotion and then this is going to spur me on to do great and amazing things. It takes time, it takes practice. But if we can reframe guilt as an opportunity to improve ourselves, I think that's what we should be striving for rather than restricting ourselves from even thinking about guilt. You know, and there's a bit of a conundrum there.
Yeah, I love the way you frame that. I'm going to need to take that now. Guilt is an opportunity.
We created a new code.
Yeah. Yeah.
Perfect. Emma, did you have any thoughts on that? Sorry.
Yeah, I was really curious about can you diagnose shame? Can you see it? Can you know that you have it? Can you see it in other people? That's what I think confuses me. I totally think you're 100% right. But then if shame is the bad thing, how do we expose it so that we can move it towards guilt?
It's amazing what you just said there. And it's not, I guess, like shame, not necessarily the bad thing, but just unhelpful. Like just, you know, is it helping you be the person you want to be and live the life you want to live? No, because shame makes us... There's an amazing, amazing psychologist who I have a massive girl crush on called Brené Brown, who many of your listeners might know, you guys will know. And she, obviously, she's has deep expertise in the psychology of shame. And she talks about that for shame to exist, it needs silence. So it breeds like in the petri dish of silence of like, because I'm not going to talk about it because I'm ashamed of it. So now I can't tell you that I picked whatever was, you know, the example of like I picked something out from the bin or whatever it might have been because I'm ashamed of it because I think there's something wrong with me for doing that. Whereas actually, if you see that as a behavior, let's think of it in the context. Let's think of it as to what that behavior is. What purpose is it serving for you? Because at some point in life, that behavior may have been what got you through a really tough time seeking comfort in food or whatever it might be or whoever it is we're talking to. So when we can just try and depersonalize it somehow and just think, what is this behavior doing for me? So if I don't feel good about myself and I shrink back and I don't want to go out for dinner with my friends, that's serving a purpose. It's trying to make me feel feel safe, it's coming at a cost because I'm now losing the opportunity to connect. And that's the thing we now need to talk about. So, it's just fascinating.
Yeah, yeah. And I love talking about this because to your point, Emma, it's very hard to objectively define, I think, for a lot of people, whether they are experiencing shame or another word to describe their feelings. And it's the same way I try and explain to people the various levels or the spectrum of low mood and depression. On one hand, you have what I describe as subclinical depression, where you can still perform your daily activities, but you generally feel low, but not low enough where you fall into the clinical spectrum, where you can't get out of bed, you're having ruminations, you're not eating, your sleep is disturbed, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I think to a degree, we all experience some shame. And we all experience the wide vernacular of, or the wide spectrum of different emotions, but to varying degrees. And this is to your point, Katie. This is why it's hard to have a discussion about this on social media, where most of your message is being miscommunicated.
And yet, it's so important too. And there's so much amazing stuff out there on social media, both as a platform, like Marcus Rashford's doing around child poverty, or there's so much beauty and brilliance in social media. We wouldn't be here connected now if it wasn't for social media. So I think it's just let's keep talking about it. And then being able to stop and think, actually, like this, this sort of mantra that I'm not my thoughts, because you have thoughts in the same way as I have toes, but I'm not my toes. As though suddenly when it comes to our thoughts, we fuse with them so much. And so if I'm having thoughts that feel shaming of there's something wrong with me, I shouldn't know, I don't want anyone to know that about me, then being able to step back and think, I noticed that I'm having these thoughts. And in that space between me and the thought, is space for me to think differently of, actually, would I want my friend to feel like that? What would I say to my best mate if they were in that situation, and find a bit of a wiser, more compassionate voice? And then we're starting to learn and work with our thoughts and feelings rather than being driven by them. Because, you talk there about your depression and subclinical, and like that sort of belief that we should be happy every day is just so, so unhelpful.
Yeah.
That our brains are built to make, that actually they're built to be negative. Yeah, I love that kind of story. I think it was Russ Harris who talks about that. If you imagine back in caveman era, you've got, I hope this isn't too much of a tangent, but if you've got two cavemen, Bob and Bill. Bob is really positive. He's really happy. He's like, yeah, this is great. And Bill is just really anxious and worried about everything and thinks the worst case scenario all the time. If there's a rustling in the bush over there, Bob is going to be like, oh, woo, friend, let's go. And Bill's going like, oh, could be a dangerous predator. I'm going to seek cover and hide. If it is a predator, Bob's dead. Bill survives. So negativity and worry and doubt and insecurity is an evolutionary useful trait. And that's how our brains have evolved to actually, it's helpful to think the worst, to worry, to be anxious, to, and all the rest of it. So once we've got that primitive thinking machine, and all of us have, we didn't get any choice of that. You had that at birth. It's not even anything to do with you. And that part is the one that then runs so many people's lives. And that's the part that then thinks, like, I need to look a certain way in order to be accepted, because, back in the tribe, if I didn't fit in, I'm probably not going to survive because I can't hunt with people. I'm not going to get protection if we do get attacked. Yeah, so being in a tribe was really such a survival requirement. But now, like, our tribe is like millions and millions of people that we're now comparing ourselves to. And it just creates so many problems until we start talking about it like this and seeing it for what it is.
Absolutely. That's a great tangent, because it reminds me of a conversation I had recently with Mo Gowda, who is a person who has had depression most of his life. He had to endure the loss of his young son to a freak accident during a routine surgery. And he describes our brain as running on old software, and we are currently operating old software with new hardware. And there's a disconnect between that. We have to learn how to navigate our new hardware using old software. And I think those tools about discussing how our brains work, for example, understanding the negativity bias, are super important for everyone to understand, not just children, but also adults. And Emma, you bravely shared about, how you still have relapses and stuff. I wonder how I mean, it's really authentic and really encouraging that you're able to have to be able to talk about that even now, even today. I mean, what sort of coping mechanisms do you rely on to get you through?
Oh, that's a really great question. I think I just have more trust in myself. So what you were saying, Katie, about the negativity being quite good for us because it's a survival mechanism, I think it's really intoxicating to feel as though you've got the answers so that you don't need to learn anymore. I think that's a really intoxicating feeling. I think that also speaks to what we were talking about social media. If a meme sounds great, it's really, it can be quite seductive to think, well, I'm just going to live by that. Or somebody says I should live this way, I'm just going to do that. And actually, I think one of the things that I rely on is seeing the part on the bone that was broken becomes the strongest part. So even though I was very quickly able to catch what happened at the weekend, it was a really good signpost, essentially, because I was able to go sit down and, you know what it's like when you read a book or you learn something for the first time, you retain it for a while and then you might forget bits and you need to go back and revisit. So I just saw it as a really good opportunity to pick up that book, go to the highlighted sections, remind myself of the things that I know to be true, also just slow down, and also just honestly, without sounding like an egomaniac, just thank myself for what I've done to this point so far. Just go, actually, do you know what? In the grand scheme of things, you've done really well. So today was a bad day. You caught it. It doesn't need to be a bad day anymore. It was just, it doesn't even need to have the bad assigned to it. It was just an opportunity to look back and go, right, you've done this. I think about, okay, what if I hadn't read that book and had gone into lockdown? That is something I think about, like, because of my toxic relationship with food, would I have relied on it really heavily? Could lockdown have actually been really quite dangerous for me? So I just was thankful for the fact that, thank goodness you read that book before, you know, 6 months before lockdown, because you got your head together before you were then presented with something that would have been really challenging given your previous headspace. So I think it is a long-winded way of just saying there aren't any specific coping mechanisms in that I don't go to a particular website or what have you. But I think it's just revisiting your progress and acknowledging the progress that you've made. And then you don't want to then go out and sabotage it, because you think, you sort of tot it up and it's like counting out your money and putting it all in one place and seeing it. You go, actually, there's a lot there. I'm gonna not spend that. I'm going to investor, I mean, a high yield interest account, and I'm going to capitalize on it, and I'm going to make more of it. So I think that's why I'm not too upset about what happened at the weekend, and why I'm happy to talk about it, because what I also don't want to do is be one of those voices on social media who says, I read a book and look, because before I read the book, all you saw of me on social media was from the neck up. And then gradually I started to, you know, the camera started to zoom out and people started asking me, have you had bariatric surgery? What diet are you on? There was a lot of interest and I was ignoring people. And then I decided to address it. And so I was honest with what had happened. But I think it would be really disingenuous of me to present that. I read the book and now look, I've dropped 30 pounds and clearly I'm more confident, not because of my weight loss, but because of the other issues, the mental issues, and the fact that I've sort of sorted my head out. So I would feel very disingenuous if I didn't say, but it's not linear. And there have been setbacks. I still beat myself up some days, but I am able to catch it because of the work that I did a couple of years ago.
See, I think that's such a beautiful answer. And like, I almost feel like people like rewind that and listen to that again. Because like within that, you talk just to pull out a couple of things that I heard that I thought were brilliant. It's like, they're simple, but those are the best things. It's like, you used to slow down, because the primitive part of your brain that was trying to hijack you in that moment is really fast. It's sort of five times faster than your logical, your real self. You know, once you try and think about prefrontal cortex and all the rest of it, which is where you're thinking, hang on a minute, let's look at how far I've come. So in slowing down, sometimes that is all we need to do to then allow the kinder voice to kick in. And then you talked about like thankfulness. So like once we're feeling a bit anxious, the antidote to anxiety is often gratitude. So if we can switch to a point of gratitude of like, actually, I'm really proud of myself. I'm really proud and I'm really thankful that I read that book and I've made this. Like, there's so much wisdom in what you talked about. Have you heard of, you know, that Japanese phrase, kintsugi? it's similar to what you're talking about there, you know, that when you, in Japanese sort of culture, if you break a bowl or whatever, they then put it together with gold. Yeah. And that's it. So it's through our imperfections that we become valuable and beautiful and all of that sort of stuff. So yeah, I loved that.
That's brilliant. Yeah. I mean, that for me, I know that that Japanese concept, and for me it's just so beautiful because again it's like finding opportunity in what might be a situation that is frustrating, embarrassing as well. And I think, you know, what's really powerful about these conversations is that we've all had personal experience with ill health, whether that be body dysmorphia, mental health problems, physical health problems. And it just reminds me, and I feel like we're going to end on this quote now, this Rumi quote, which is, "The wound is the place where the light enters you." And again, it's all about finding opportunity in places where you feel very down. And I'm not trying to suggest that it's easy. It's a process. In the same way, my meditation practice that I've been doing for years still feels very frustrating, and I don't feel like I'm anywhere near nirvana at all, or, you know, becoming a very well-rounded, rational person. But, you know, it's the process that you have to fall in love with. And I really, really enjoyed all these different concepts. It's incredible.
About 18 months ago, I had this incredible man on the podcast called Jeff Thompson. He's a prolific author, but the fact that he didn't sit in front of me as a ball of light was just because he's so enlightened. It's just incredible. But we talked about this culture a little bit, about social media, about if things trigger you. And I think that if I want to sort of say anything to anybody, because I can't give anybody a magic bullet about how to address their issues with food or how they feel about their body, but something that Jeff said, I think, is so applicable to anything that might be causing you distress, mental, physical, emotional. And that is, if something triggers you, and we are in a culture today where if something triggers you, the response is to say, please don't say that, it triggers me, and I would like you to stop. So I can't control what other people do, but I can control my response. So he basically said, if something triggers you, run towards it, interrogate it until it stops triggering you. And I feel as though, I feel strongly that that's what I did with the book. It was, I had spent a long time running away from my feelings of angst about my weight and how I looked and how I felt about myself. And the book, and the nudge points of the breast reduction and the other things, made me actually step up to it and say outside, basically offer it outside and say, let's go and have this out. And that was where the process was made. What a great analogy.
I know. But also, I love how, like, this is how contagious human beings are. Like, I think it was you who started the quote, and now we're all just buzzing on quotes. And like, Rupi, you now made me think of the other Rumi quote, which is one of my favorites, which is like something along the lines of, there is out beyond right doing or wrong doing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. Which is what I feel like this conversation has been about. It's like, no one's got the answer, have they? We're all figuring it out. Let's not label things right or wrong. Let's just chat, let's connect, and let's see what emerges from that. Because human beings are such amazing creatures that so much good stuff can come when we do that. So yeah, I think we need it. To now ask all the listeners like for their favourite quotes, and we're going to like double our quote.
Yeah, I know, I love it. That's brilliant. You can check out all those quotes and more at thedoctorskitchen.com, where you'll also be able to sign up for Katie's online course, plus check out my guest bios and much more. Thank you so much for listening this week. I'll see you next time.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.